Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Leonard Nimoy, author of a new book, I Am Spock, author of an earlier book, I Am Not Spock, well-known director and actor, perhaps best known for the role of Spock in the Star Trek TV series. Why is the book titled I Am Spock?
Well, I'm curious about this. As I hear you announce it, it sounds bizarre. When I did the first book, when I did I Am Not Spock, I was totally naive about the potential response to that title. I had no idea that I would get such hostility. I say in this book that I made a mistake with the title of the first book, and I think I did. It was a miscalculation. I had no idea that there would be this interpretation, which was Nimoy wants nothing to do with Star Trek. He wants to disassociate himself from Star Trek and the Spock character. And that truly was not what the book was about. I said in the book that I liked Spock, I enjoyed him, I admired him, and that I felt good being identified with him. And that if I had to make a choice of all the characters in television to be identified with, I would choose Spock. That book, 20 years ago, was in response to a lot of questions that were being asked at the time, which were, for example, how did you get the role? How did the character develop? How much of you is Spock? Who are you, / Spock? Where is the dividing line between you and the character? How did the makeup develop? Tell us about the ears. Tell us about the skin coloration. Tell us about the Vulcan mind meld, the neck pinch, and the Vulcan salute. Tell us about your favorite episodes. These were some of the questions that I was being asked, and I answered them in the book, and then decided that I Am Not Spock would be an interesting title for the book, and thought-provoking, and what it was controversial. Those who read the book understood what the point was, but those who did not read the book and assessed the title had this very hostile, negative reaction. But I let it go. Once we started to do the Star Trek movies in 1979, the whole issue became moot. Although there was a little bump, when we made Star Trek II and Spock died, now the hangover assumption from this original title of the book was Nimoy has had the character killed. Nimoy contracted to have the character die off in Star Trek II. It was done by contract. The answer was that was not true. But that was somewhat the assumption. Then I came back in 3, and again, the issue became moot. So I think by now it's clear that I've had a pretty good association with the character in Star Trek. I directed two of the movies, wrote story for two of them, produced one of them. But finally, after many years of people asking if I would ever do a sequel to I Am Not Spock, and joking about it and responding with something like, well, probably I will someday, and I'll probably call it Maybe I Am After All. I finally decided that I had a handle on it last year, that I could bring it to some closure and clear the decks here. And that's why I wrote this book.
I know you leave the door open in the book, at the end of the book. Do you plan on playing Spock again on, say, Deep Space Nine?
It's not actually up to me. Some other person has to make the decision that they'd like this to happen. And I have said time and again that I will respond to a phone call. I will listen to a proposal. I came to the Next Generation producers with the idea of my appearance there, but that was because at the time I was producing Star Trek VI. And frankly, it seemed like a very good way to cross-reference and to help build the anticipation for Star Trek VI by doing an appearance on Next Generation, which was sort of a teaser for the Star Trek VI Final Frontier story. And since then, the only communication I've had with the Star Trek people was the 2 years ago when they asked if I would direct or appear in Generations, the movie. I read the script, I was not attracted to it, and I let it go.
Dick Lupoff.
There have been many cases of an actor so closely identified with a particular character that you automatically think of Sherlock Holmes, Basil Rathbone, Karloff and Lugosi as their respective monsters. Do you feel that in this kind of situation, it somehow impedes recognition or development of your career in other directions?
I suppose it does, but it's a double-edged sword. For me, it has been. I've heard the legends of people who have been so identified with a particular character that they were never cast in any other. George Reeves committed suicide.
Yeah. Yes.
And the legend was that he did so because he was despondent about not being able to get other work outside of Superman. So, you know, I've heard these stories. I haven't had that problem. I can't report to you any given conversation that I have with my agent or producer or director who said, we're not going to hire you for this role that you want to play because you're identified with Spock. I've never had that conversation. What I get is the positive issues, when the calls that come from people who do want to hire me for other jobs. And I've had enough of those that I don't consider it a problem. Now, typecasting, I say it's a double-edged sword because of this. Typecasting is perceived to be a stigma. When I was making the Star Trek series, people would say to me, what are you going to do after this? And I said, what do you mean? You know, what's the problem here? Aren't you afraid of being typecast? It's like, aren't you afraid of getting this disease, you know? And the fact is, typecasting can be a very positive factor for an actor. If you are typed in a positive way, meaning that they have a sense of the kinds of roles that you can play, a certain person can play, for example, laboring people. You're believable as a person who works with his hands, a plumber, a carpenter, whatever. Other people are credible as intellectuals, scientists, college professors, and so forth. Other people are believable as politicians, if that is an oxymoron, you know. You can play politicians, you can play mayors, you can play lawyers, whatever. So that's helpful. That's helpful. If you are like the kind of person who is difficult to cast, difficult to identify with a certain kind of role, you could have a problem and you could be out of work. So in that respect, I think typecasting has been useful to me.
I'd like to ask some questions about your pre-Star Trek career. In your new book, I Am Spock, you mention Kid Monk Baroni. Tell me a little bit about films like Queen for a Day, Francis Goes to West Point, and that all-time classic, Zombies of the Stratosphere.
The very first time I ever went on an audition or an interview for a movie and got the job, it was a movie called Queen for a Day. Queen for a Day in the 30s, I believe, was a successful radio program and then later became a TV program. The idea of the show was something of a contest. Various women were brought on the show to talk about why they believed that they deserved to be Queen for a Day or what their need was in their life. I've put 7 kids through school and I've got 1 more kid and I need some money and I'm working 3 jobs and my husband fell and hurt his back, and each person would tell their story. And then the audience would respond by applause, and the winner by applause would become Queen for a Day, be brought to Hollywood, limousined around town, taken to the Brown Derby for lunch or whatever, meet a couple of movie stars, and maybe the wish that was the tuition for the school, for the youngster, whatever, would be paid, and that one person would spend the day like that. And somebody made a movie of 3 short stories of women who became Queen for a Day, and I had a very small role. I played the buddy of a guy whose mother became Queen for a Day. You know, I think I was a cousin twice removed from the story. But that was my first job ever in film. And then I had a couple of other minute roles in a movie called Rhubarb with Ray Milland and Jan Sterling, a story about the cat that inherited the Brooklyn baseball team. Francis Goes to West Point, one of the series of Talking Mule movies in which I played a West Point football player. I think I had 1 or 2 lines of dialogue. And Kid Monk Baroni came along, which I played the title role. It was a very important role, obviously, in the film, but a very unimportant film, very small, very modest little movie made for a minuscule budget. And that was the beginning of the career.
Did you have any thoughts at that point about television? Were you looking for any work in live TV in those days?
I was looking for work any place I could get it. There wasn't any meaningful amount of work in television, but I did get a job eventually on a live TV show. There was a variety show being produced in Los Angeles called The Pinky Lee Show. Pinky Lee was a comic of the period, a minuscule little guy who had a kind of a beanie cap. His appeal was to kids. And he would dance around sort of Eddie Cantor-like and saying, "Hello, hello, my name is Pinky Lee." And then they would do sketches. And in the sketches, it was often the mistaken identity sketch where a bunch of gangsters are after Pinky because they think he's got the money, you know. And I was one of those gangsters.
What about Zombies of the Stratosphere? That was Commander Cody, was it not? Or Commando Cody?
It was a similar, yeah. It was a different story. I don't know the connection exactly. The connection that I know of is that Commando Cody wore a backpack and a bullet-shaped helmet and flew through the air. And a character with that equipment appeared in Zombies of the Stratosphere. I don't think he was called Commando or Commander Cody in our serial. I think it was called something else. But he was the same guy with a backpack. And he had a little button on his stomach, a dial on his stomach, on a little panel that said up or down, depending on what kind of altitude he wanted, you know. If he switched to up, he went up. If he switched to down, he came down like a bullet.
But who was Leonard Nimoy in this film?
I was one of the zombies. What else? I told you I was typecast.
When you were doing that, you were 20, 21, 22 yeah. years old. How did you feel? Were you thinking, what about my career? What were your thought processes? Or were they simply, oh, wow, money for food?
I was thinking, I'm in a movie. I'm in a movie. They're paying me, and I'm acting in a movie. And I want another one of these and another one of these as soon as possible. I didn't care. A job was a job. I was always working at other things to support myself. But every once in a while, when these movie jobs came along, I went to work. The Zombies of the Stratosphere was I think, perhaps the last of the Republic Saturday serials that they used to do, where you saw 15-minute episodes every week for 12 weeks. Cliffhangers. At the end of every episode, the hero or heroine was in desperate trouble and probably was about to be run over by a train or something. It was about a spaceship comes from Mars with three or four of us on board, and with some Colt 38 revolvers and a pickup truck, we're going to knock Earth out of its orbit. Because we want this orbit. This is a good orbit, and we want it.
You know? So you've been associated with a high intellectual concept, science fiction, all your life.
The best. Always with the best.
After that, but before Star Trek, you worked in a wide variety of different television shows, Wagon Train, a number of others. Do any of those stand out in particular?
I also worked in a lot of other kinds of jobs, like jerking sodas in an ice cream parlor and working in a tropical fish store for a year and a half and delivering newspapers and driving a taxi. I did whatever work I could get. I did a couple of Wagon Trains, one with Ernie Borgnine was a pretty good role, and he was helpful to me, gave me some good hints, some good advice on the character I was playing. I worked in Rawhide with Clint Eastwood. I did a lot of Indian roles, Indian characters, did a lot of Hispanic characters, Italian kids. I was castable in ethnic roles. The last guest starring role that I did before we started filming the Star Trek series, I got the job just around the time that I got word that Star Trek had sold and were going into production, was in a Gunsmoke, in which I played an Indian called Walking Fox. The title of the show was The Treasure of John Walking Fox. And it was a rather clever script about an Indian whose white man friend was killed by some bad people, and he sets about to create a vengeance situation in a very clever way. That was the last thing I did, with the buckskin clothes and the horse and the wig and the whole thing.
When Star Trek began and you saw that role, did you see any of the future potential for it? I know you said that you had trouble getting a handle on it, and suddenly it clicked in.
It was difficult at first. I was struggling to find my way to a neatly packaged character. I was reaching out for a bit of this and a bit of that, and trying to find a way to make the whole thing coalesce. The makeup took a while to come together. At first, the eyebrows were kind of bushy and shaggy. The haircut, the bangs were jagged at first and not neatly cut. The ears were pretty good by the time we got on the air, but before we started shooting, we had trouble with it. The dialogue wasn't clear in the dialogue really exactly what this character was all about yet. We were all fishing for the character. For me, it came together in a moment after we started filming the series, in an episode called The Corbomite Maneuver, where everybody was rushing about on the bridge, were being blocked, our path was being blocked by some obstacle in space, and whichever way the Enterprise turns, there it is again, threatening us, and everybody getting excited, and the captain's yelling his orders, and people are yelling their responses. And I had one word to say, and the word was fascinating. And I joined in the adrenaline that everybody else had going, and when it came to my turn to speak, I said, "Fascinating!" And the director, Joe Sargent, a good friend of mine before and since, said, "Why don't you do this as a curious scientist rather than as an excited member of the crew?" And I thought about that, and I thought, why not? It's an interesting idea. Let's try it. And when it came my turn to speak instead of the other, I said, "Fascinating," or "Fascinating." I don't remember exactly. But I said it curiously rather than excitedly. And the character began to come to life. We began to understand that this character could be unique.
What about the well-known rapport between the various people in Star Trek? I know that it's kind of been ripped apart lately by different autobiographies, which leave you in a good light and say not such very nice things about Shatner. But at the time, particularly if we look at the blooper reel, it seems like you guys were all pals.
I got along well with everybody. I never had any trouble with anybody in the company. Bill Shatner and I had our differences on creative issues when we were making the series, but those were creative issues. It had to do with keeping credibility for character. What's the proper Spock function? What's the proper Kirk function in a script and so forth? But on a personal level, I never had any negative experiences with any of these people, and I'm sorry that to this day to hear that some people are still carrying these resentments. I think it's time to let it go.
Did you sometimes act as intermediary for them with Shatner?
No, when Bill came to me a couple of years ago and said, "I'd appreciate some time. I want to interview you about your recollections about some of the things that were happening when we were making the shows. I'm doing a book, and I need to talk to you." I said, "Sure." He came to my house, and when he came, he had spoken to some of these other people, and he said to me, he was genuinely surprised. He said, "Some of these people are very angry at me." I said, "Really?" He said, "Oh, God, I mean, it's tough to get them to talk to me. They're so angry about this or that." I said, "Well," he was genuinely surprised. And I think that's probably the way I feel about it. I was busy acting. I don't know what was going on.
In your book, I Am Spock, you're generally very kind to all of the people on the creative side of the show. But you have some words about network executives, which are a little bit less kind. What's the story there?
I may be unfair. The people that I'm very specific about are people who I met and knew and worked with. Roddenberry, Bob Justman, Gene Kuhn, the directors, Bill Shatner, the crew. I never had any personal interaction with the network people. But I did feel their presence when we had made the first pilot. And I suppose because I was on the mailing list, now I'm connected with Star Trek. So when they put out Star Trek literature, I got some in the mail. And what I saw was a sales brochure with a sort of synopsis about what the show was going to be about and some photographs, the production photographs of the show. And on a second look, I realized that there's something wrong with this picture, that in whatever photographs I saw my character Spock, they had airbrushed out the points off of my ears, and they had straightened out my eyebrows so they didn't have that upswept look. I called Gene Roddenberry, and I said, "Have you seen this?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Are you aware of what they've done?" And he said, "Yes." "What does this mean?" said I to Gene. And he said, "Well, the network salespeople are concerned that this character may cause some problems for them in selling the show. They believe that in the Bible Belt, for example, some people might think that Spock is satanic and therefore not welcome in their homes on their TV sets. There's a concern that in the American family watching television, there should be a father for the fathers in the family to identify with, a mother for the mothers to identify with, a child for the children, and preferably a pet like a dog for the animal lovers. Who's going to identify with this guy with the pointy ears?" was the question. And after the show went on the air, and we got the big response that we did to the Spock character. It was incredible. It took off like a rocket, if you'll pardon the symmetry here. They asked for more Spock. They said, "Give us more of that guy with the pointy ears. People like him." And they have no problem turning about in their position. They say, well, we've changed our mind. We want more of him. You know, so there was more Spock.
In your book, I Am Spock, Leonard Nimoy, you talk about the origins of the Vulcan hand, hand thing, and involved the Kabbalah and your Jewish background. Was that background part of your own ideas about Spock, or do you think it was separate?
No, not really. I used that symbol because I thought it had some kind of interesting magical connotation to it, and it seemed appropriate for the Vulcans. It really was not a direct connection to Judaism that I was suggesting. It was simply a gesture that I had discovered out of my own personal life, and an actor brings something out of his kit bag to a character, and that was one of the things that I brought. I do think that there are connections that I can make a case for. I think Star Trek has always been about a society that values education, that values curiosity, that values life in all its forms, values diversity, certainly values social justice. And I think these are tenets of Judaism, so you could say that there are parallels. But there wasn't any specific intent to connect the two.
And to that degree, Spock wasn't a mystic.
No, not really, no.
You write in the book a good deal about the fan phenomenon, which on the face of it looks like a wonderful, amusing, healthy hobby, mostly for young people, but not necessarily. People of any age can become involved. On the other hand, do you agree that there is a potential danger of people becoming obsessed with something like a TV show?
I have traveled in the last 30 years around this country a lot, and I've spoken on a lot of college campuses on the subject of Star Trek and various other activities in which I've been involved, and I've performed on college campuses in various plays that I've developed or whatever. And very, very often, when I've come to a college campus and I'm picked up by the students at the airport, they drive me onto the campus and they point out the various buildings. This is our sociology department, this is our science department, and so forth. And this, I very often hear proudly, is our new stadium. This stadium costs blah, 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 $1 million, and this stadium will seat blah, 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 tens of thousands of people. Very often, because of my interest, I'll say, where's your theater? And very often out here, we don't have one. The plays are done in the rec hall, or the gym is turned into a theater temporarily for the productions. Do we worry about that obsession? Do we worry about that expenditure, about people's obsession with sitting in front of the football TV set watching football games or spending that kind of money on football? I don't think so. So I ask myself, what is this concern about people's interest in Star Trek? Is it real or is it a concoction? Is it a spin, sort of? You know, is it a concocted drama? Oh, these poor people. Because Bill Shatner did a very funny thing on Saturday Night Live in which, talking about Star Trek fans, he said, get a life, you know. Well, the same could be said about people who are involved in stamp collecting. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be Star Trek. Is there something destructive about being involved with Star Trek? I don't think so. I think you'll find that most people can make a case for the fact that it's had a very beneficial effect on their lives, and that's my position on it.
After Star Trek, you got a break by directing a Star Trek film, and you've branched out since with one extraordinary movie called The Good Mother. You were the director. How do you like directing?
I love directing. I don't often like the result. I've had some great successes, and I've had some disastrous failures. And I've had some disappointments, and The Good Mother was one of them. I think The Good Mother is an important film. I was greatly passionate about making it. I enjoyed the work every day because I was working with some very, very talented professional people with a wonderful script and a great story by Sue Miller from her book of the same name, The Good Mother. And I thought we had a very important, wonderful film. The problem, realized afterward in the same way that I was naive about the title of I Am Not Spock, is that the problem is it's a negative film. It's a movie that does not end happily. It's a movie that makes a negative statement about our society, which is that we are incapable of accepting or unwilling to accept sexuality in a mother. We want those roles separated. And when this mother in this film is discovered to be having a sexual life, she's punished for it. in a sort of a puritanical way. It's an unhappy story, and some people appreciated the film a lot and said this is putting a light on a truth, and other people said this is a terrible thing to a terrible story to tell because it sends the wrong message. It says that this woman is correctly punished, and it becomes a cautionary tale. And I was disappointed by the reception, but I'm proud of the film.
Do you plan on doing more directing?
Only if I can find something that is worth the time and effort, and if I become compelled to make it, because I know now what goes into the making of one of these movies, and I know that if there is not a satisfactory reception down at the end of the line, one feels that you've spent a big portion of your life and energy making this product, and I don't have the obsession just to make movies. If I can find a proper script, I'd be happy to do it, sure.
Tell me about working with Ingrid Bergman.
Well, that was one of the great treats that came out of Star Trek. I'm very grateful for that opportunity. I was negotiating for an appearance in Star Trek II, and one of the things the studio offered to give me was what they called a couple of pay-or-play commitments, meaning that aside from my salary for acting as Spock in Star Trek, I would be given a couple of other jobs or paid for them, whether I did them or not. And one of those turned out to be the role of Morris Meyerson, Golda Meir's husband, in A Woman Called Golda. And the role of Golda was played by Judy Davis as the younger Golda and Ingrid Bergman as the older. Certainly one of my all-time favorite films, if not the all-time favorite, is Casablanca. And Bergman in that is so wonderful, as she was in so many other roles. She was a great actress, a great actress. And it was a great thrill to me to play the scenes with her. She was ill when we made the picture. She had cancer. She was suffering from a swelling in an arm, evidently a gland problem, but I never saw any evidence of it, except the only evidence was in the way she dressed. You could see that they were dressing her with clothes that were covering her swollen arm. But other than that, there was never any sense of I'm tired or I'll have to come in late tomorrow or skip a day or none of that. She was totally there on the job. And I was absolutely thrilled and honored to be working with her. She won the Emmy for that performance. I was nominated for an Emmy, which was, I was very grateful for. I spoke to her some weeks after we had done the job, and I was passing through London where she lived, and she said that she had taken herself off of the medication, the chemotherapy, because she said, frankly, it's just making me feel too sick, and I don't want to feel that sick. Right? It isn't worth it to me. She said, I've told my doctor I'm stopping. And she went out that night to the theater, and then a few weeks later she was gone.
Would you tell the story of the touching of hands on the set in that film?
We had this one major scene to play, which was the reenactment of the night of the announcement of the Israeli independence and the Declaration of Independence. And she, of course, was a major figure. And her ex-husband, I as Morris Meyerson, her ex-husband comes to visit her to congratulate her on the day and to have some communication about their children that they had in common. One of my concerns in playing with her and acting with her was that I should appear as her husband and not appear as a deferential young actor who was idolizing this lady. You know, so when we began to play the scene and we started to walk as we were directed to in the scene with the camera following, I reached out for her hand as a gesture of friendship from an ex-husband. And when I took her hand in mine, she immediately put her other hand on top of mine and grasped my hand in both her hands, and I thought, it was the right thing to do, and she has welcomed it, and we have found a way to play the scene. It was a wonderful, literally a touching moment for me.
Leonard Nimoy, what do you think of the new Star Trek spin-offs, Deep Space Nine and Voyager? Have you seen them? And secondly, how come no other space program other than the Roddenberry or Roddenberry-derived shows has been able to work on television?
I can't speak about other shows intelligently, really. I mean that. I haven't seen enough of them, and I don't know which shows you're speaking of specifically. Some of the other science fiction shows seem to be doing okay. Babylon 5 has found a place in the market, and some others. I also have not seen enough of Deep Space Nine or Voyager to honestly make comment. Except to say this, I'm quite surprised at the great success of The Next Generation. I think they did extremely well. I was skeptical when they came on the air, I really wondered if, and I think it had to do with ego. I thought to myself, can they do this without us? Weren't we pivotal to the success of the show? And the answer was yes, thank you very much. We can do it without you. And they did extremely well. Talented people doing a very good job. Deep Space Nine, I think I am correct in saying, has a built-in problem because it doesn't boldly go anywhere. It's a static space station. Voyager has a chance to correct that problem. We'll see what happens.
And finally, Wither Leonard Nimoy, what's on tap for you?
I'm not actively looking for projects. I'm having a lot of fun with a comic book series that I developed with Isaac Asimov. It's called Primordials. It's been on the stands for a year. We have just made a deal to do a hardcover novel of it next year, so that's going to happen. I'm developing another novel, which I'm having a good time with. I think I'm much more interested these days in working by phone, fax, and FedEx than presenting the body at 5 o'clock in the morning and sitting down in the makeup chair.
We've been talking on Cover to Cover with Leonard Nimoy. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard Lupoff.